Hello and welcome to the Open Era Podcast. My name is Simon Bushell. Devang Desai, still on the shelf, is getting there, I think. Had a nice conversation with Dev this week where he said he was on the mend and we're hoping to record together. I fly to Toronto in a couple of weeks' time and I'm hoping to record with him at the start of next season. So fingers crossed, everyone can stay tuned for that one. In the meantime, we are very fortunate. Priyanka Dobson, Patreon extraordinaire, joining us for the show. Thank you so much for coming on, Priyanka.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to hear that Devang's on the mend, and I feel like you guys needed an Arsenal fan for it to feel normal, like for it to feel like he was here. So I'm happy to step into those shoes.
Let's get things up and running. The WTA took an incredibly bold stance this week and I think saw some plaudits from around the sporting world and the wider geopolitical world as well. They suspended all tournaments within the country of China and in Hong Kong. Steve Simon, president, releasing a statement basically saying the entire situation was, quote, unacceptable. And to, quote, continue that quote from Simon, if powerful people can suppress the voices of women and sweep allegations of sexual assault under the rug, then the basis on which the WTA was founded, equality for women, would suffer an immense setback. I will not and cannot let that happen to the WTA and its players. Priyanka, I would like to add my voice to the plaudits for this. I think the wider sporting community applauded this decision, and I think here at Open Era we support that as well.
I was really glad to see it. The bar is so low for sports organizations. I think a bunch of folks were surprised that they actually were going to put their money where their mouth was, or take their money, for lack of a better word. And I was trying to think about why I was so impressed. And it just feels like there's no real precedent for an association taking a stand like this for its players. Like, you think of the U.S. Gymnastics Association that really failed its athletes. I know the Women's Beach Volleyball Federation had a kerfuffle earlier this year with attire and everything like that, which is a much less serious issue. So it was really great to see the WTA actually stand behind its players and put their money where their mouth is.
You know, someone who didn't know, and that's the ATP. It's also the ITF. This one was, I think the fallout of this was actually quite positive. I think when a federation releases a statement like the ATP did, and it is so roundly criticized by the entire sport, I think it's easy to fall into a trap where you just be cynical about the fact that they haven't done it. But I actually think the response to it from the wider community was quite positive, because this is the kind of attitude that does force change overall. I would read the ATP statement, but it's kind of bollocks. Let's be honest. There's nothing in here that's particularly useful.
It's a word salad. It's kind of as if they did like the iPhone autocomplete of words of a statement type thing. That's what it read like to me. It was just, these are words. That's what this is.
I think the quote that sort of took everyone out of this, which was, quote, "We will continue to consult with our members and monitor any developments as this issue evolves." I mean, there's literally nothing of substance within a quote like this. And I think they were roundly criticized, honestly, across the entire sporting landscape. As much positive press as the WTA received, I think the ATP received as much, if not more, criticism for the stance of not being in solidarity with their fellow tour. And if you ever want to talk about all the mechanics and minutiae and power dynamics that exist in sport, how can you end up with a scenario where one of your organizations takes this stance and your other organization doesn't support them? I mean, that's ridiculous to me.
It's absolutely wild. They don't even use her name in the statement. You know, they speak about it in such vague terms. And it was really heartening to see the response from current and former players. And even before they came out with their statement, when the WTA came out with their statement, and you have players like Tennis Sandgren coming out and saying, "Where's our statement? You know, how are we going to stand behind them?" And then when they come out with something so limp, like with absolutely no teeth to it, it was again heartening to see all the players get to respond and get to throw their support, but also really exposed how little opportunity they have to like come together, right? Like Players Council or ATP Council, like how do they actually say they did want to do something as players? Like what recourse do they have?
Yeah, it's completely fair. I think before we touch on some of the players that spoke up against the ATP, if you can call it that. We'll call it that for the time being. I just want to touch on things that Steve Simon said within his quote when they chose to suspend tournaments in China. Talking about the basis of which the WTA was founded, equality for women, things like power dynamics as well. This is such at the core of what this organization was set up to be. And the pioneers who came before in this fight in a lot of ways. I think you can call it being romantic about the whole thing. But I actually do agree with the basis of this statement, which is that this is an organization, the women that came before in this fought so hard to get to this position. And the reason there is things like equal prize money is because of people who fought for so damn long to get there that an issue such as sexual assault, which is so prevalent in wider society, and we've seen in sports and a wider cultural movement with Me Too and all the things that come with it. This was a touch point for the WTA. And I felt like if they didn't answer this call, then I'm not sure the people that came before it would stand for this.
Absolutely. And that's why, again, that it's so impressive to all of us that they did it. And again, why we all have to reflect on why we thought they wouldn't, you know, like considering the basis of the principles that they were founded on, like you said, their point of protecting their players, like you would think it would be a natural thing that they would do. And yet there was so much doubt that they would actually do it, which I think that just speaks to the nature of sporting leagues and how they stand up for their players and how they stand up against these really complex issues, which is they often don't. So it was really glad to see all of our expectations kind of out. It was really heartening to see all of our low expectations actually be cleared.
I think that's the basis of wider society as well, isn't it? That we want we want morality to win, and so often it doesn't. The money comes first on this stuff, and to see one occasion where that happens, we don't know, right? Like the ramifications of what this looks like. There wasn't any tournaments in the near future, from my understanding. Like this is still a suspension of tournaments, so this can easily come back, and we're yet to see the fallout of what happens from this. But there were some pretty sharp criticism of the ATP from some fairly high profile members of the tour and people and legends of the tour, not least Martina Navratilova. Quote, are we to understand that the ATP would have made the same statement had the player been a male, an ATP tour pro? Somehow I think not. Hashtag embarrassing. I mean, she's not wrong. I think she's probably correct on that one, despite Navratilova having some questionable opinions on some things. Former world number one Annie Roddick also saying that the ATP statement was an example of how to say a lot of words and say nothing, joined by his, I guess, BFF, Marty Fish, who was also very, very critical of it. And you mentioned and touched on Tennis Sandgren, someone who has been all over the map and someone I think I can fairly say I would not get on too well with over a beer, but I feel like he's been pretty strong on this issue as well. And quote directly, it's important to understand that we as players are completely handcuffed in our ability to act as a collective. And our leadership from the ATP is a complete dumpster. Sure sounds like you need a union there, Mr. Sandgren. Sure sounds like you need some collective action. But how did you feel this week netted out with some of the reactions that you saw from past and present players?
I was pretty impressed given that the players and how they've spoken about this Zverev situation has not always been great. You know, one of their own, we saw the tweets from Djokovic and even Federer saying, oh, he's a good guy, always. He's had a tough year on and off the court. And so once again, my bar was very low for folks not only coming out to say, former players coming out to say anything, but even current players actually criticizing their leadership. I mean, it goes back to the awkward setup of players and associations and other contractors and not contractors and all these legal things that folks have brought up with regard to the Zverev situation of like how the ATP would even quote unquote punish him. So all that to say, it's an awkward relationship, but I'm glad sometimes social media is good, I guess, that they do have a forum to be able to air their feelings out, even if they can't take any action themselves. I maybe wanted to also hear more again, as I talk about the low bars and as I'm like, oh, I'm impressed. Tennis Sandgren, who I also don't think I'd want to get a beer with, said something. At the same time, I also want to hear more from other players unprompted. You know, maybe this will come up in press conferences as the season restarts. Maybe it won't. but I would love to hear from even more players.
There is a genuinely fascinating discussion and debate to be had of why the fallout and the response from players and organizations has been so strong against a state like China versus what happened with a case like Alexander Zverev, or you could even throw in Nicolas Bashilashvili as well. Like, these are still, these are all very, very, these are credible and, to my mind, accurate reports of sexual assault that's happened. I don't deny for any minute that any of these situations have occurred. And yet you see the difference in terms of how they were handled from the different organizations and from the players directly. I think the it's easier for a lot of people to understand, especially if you look at the people that are talking about a state like China. It almost seems a little too James Bondy, like cartoon villainy, like player says something and, you know, shadowy state appears to make the player disappear, like literally to go out of sight. And I think that's a lot easier for people to understand than the sort of power dynamics that exist of how to silence a woman in Olga Sharapova's case and the Alexander Zverev case, where you largely are trying to discredit someone as opposed to making someone just directly disappear. And I think one is much more tolerated than the other in society, which I think is a huge problem. But I thought it was fascinating to see the difference, and I'm glad that you touched upon it. Do you think that is... Why do you think that is? I'm curious. Like, why would you think that one would have such a prominent and striking response and the other was lukewarm and tepid, to say the least?
I think it's a bit of what you said of there's one, there's a, unfortunately, a clear black and white. Well, it's a complex situation, right? It's complicated. It touches on a lot of different issues when you think of domestic abuse and sexual assault and consent and all of these things, where case like Zverev's, you will see a lot more backlash and poking holes and he said, she said, and even he's come out and said, I told the courts that it was wrong and that she's libelous and all this stuff. And there's so much of a gray area to it. You would think that the Shuai case would have similar pieces, but it might just be because she was the victim and Zverev was the perpetrator, and it might be that simple. And Zverev is a rising star. One of he's a slam contender where everyone's looking for the next big three and the next athletes they can hang their hat on. He's handsome, he's, you know, winning and things like that. And it might even be an economic thing of like the bankability of Zverev. They don't want to touch that. But standing up for a former world number one player in Shuai. And I mean, again, though, it's still very impressive because like China is a big sporting state. You know, they're hosting Olympics. They used to host the tour finals in Shenzhen. Like, I just keep going back to how impressed I am with the ATP. But to answer your question, I think it's because in this case, you know, Zverev is the accused and not the accuser, unfortunately.
All right, let's talk about the IOC. I think lost in amongst all of this is the, I don't want to make light, I don't want to make levity to this whole thing, but just for a second, allow me. In amongst all of this, the WTA basically has told the IOC to go and fuck itself, which I think is quite a funny situation that you end up with an IOC that has directly inserted themselves into this situation, has tried to, in their view, offer some diplomacy to this. And the WTA has basically just said, nah, fam, like, we just don't believe you. We straight up just don't believe that what you're doing is legitimate. And I think that, against all the other things that's happened, is quite a powerful situation when you have an organization, like a global organization in the WTA, telling the IOC, like, we just do not believe you. It's pretty crazy to think about.
It's crazy to think about, and it goes back to the relationship between the Olympics and tennis that's so interesting, where the Olympics kind of need tennis more than tennis needs the Olympics. Like, every 4 years it comes around and we're like talking about the Olympics as folks are very excited to represent their country, of course, not to take away from the athletes that love to participate, but from a fan perspective, we're like, oh, it's another tournament. We have four of these, as well as many more with like Masters and all that we pay attention to. I guess we'll pay attention to the Olympic singles. So I feel like that dynamic is very different than other sports that really need the IOC and like need their support. So there's been issues even this week with a French judo champion whose coach she accused of domestic assault, and like nothing's going to happen because the IOC, you know, judo that's one of their huge tournaments. And so I feel like that's a piece of it as well, of like, if you want to play chicken, let's play chicken, but we can do very well without you. We can take our sport out of the Olympics, and it would be a bummer for the athletes, sure, but they have plenty of other opportunities.
It should be said that the IOC did engage with a second call with Peng Shuai, and for what it's worth, they also reiterated that she was not in harm's way, that she was basically fine, for lack of better phrasing. But I think this was widely denounced as well. I think everyone basically, this added nothing to what was previously there. And I think a lot of this stuff was said against some pretty interesting political backdrop as well, where, especially in the United States, you saw quite a lot of, I would say, right-leaning and Republican politicians siding with the WTA in a situation where you would argue in a lot of cases that these two would not be compatible. Like, these two institutions would not get along too well, certainly when it comes to things like abortion rights and the equivalents of it. And you end up in a situation where you directly have someone like Kelly Loeffler or someone like Ted Cruz, who are very prominent right-leaning figures, supporting the WTA and taking a stance against it. Like, I must admit, I don't know enough about United States politics to get into the minutiae of why this happened, but I do think it's fascinating. Maybe you could explain a little bit more about, I'm not asking you to dissect this from a political perspective, but I think it is a curious one to examine.
Absolutely. I mean, what's the phrase? They say a broken clock is right twice a day, from my perspective. The word, and this is, again, a very serious way to talk about it, but the word communism is such anathema in U.S. politics. So, and there's a real misunderstanding of what it is. But one thing that's clear is that China subscribes to that political system. So I feel like it's a really easy win for these right-leaning folks who like rail against it and mischaracterize it and call things that the American government doesn't provide communism, like healthcare, for example. It's easy for them to just kind of slap this label on the CCP and be correct about it. So it's one of those things where I'm not going to like the tweet. I'm not going to like comment, subscribe, and be a part of those folk situations. But at the same time, is any awareness as good awareness in that regard?
Right. So. We've seen some interesting crossovers this year as well, haven't we, with Republican figures and sporting stars, not least LeBron James, Draymond Green getting retweeted by Ted Cruz in regards to vaccine mandates. So, you know, up is down and down is up when it comes to this stuff. I wanted to close out this segment. It's a fairly long quote, but Bunny Roney was writing in The Guardian. And I think one of the things I touched upon it earlier when we were talking in this segment about how people can point fingers and say, you know, what about ism in terms of why is the WTA taking this stance and not against, you know, some oil money that's come in from the Middle East or some other states that have had horrendous human rights records? I mean, you could also point the finger at the United States' own record in a couple of ways and the fact that these organizations are based out of there. But I thought this quote actually summarized it, and I just want to dig into it quickly. Quote, "The usual mud of whataboutery and spineless moral relativism has been thrown into the mix. What about Nike and sweatshops? What about polonium poisoning? What about the US dropping the hydrogen bomb 76 years ago? It is exhausting and confusing wading through this stuff. Fruits of an exhausting and confusing world. But the fact remains, at some point, someone somewhere has to say that something is wrong. If not, we simply dissolve into the mush of powerlessness and indifference. This week, China called for politics to be kept out of sport, which is at least a good joke. But right now, sport is the global popular culture, the loudest megaphone in the room. Whatever resolution Peng can find from here, whatever happens next to the lone armada that is Steve Simon and the WTA, sailing into the mouth of their own storm, there is little left to lose from sport grabbing the mic and then speaking back." I actually really genuinely thought this caught a really nice balance between all the different things that could have been said here. And it really summarized to me, at some point, when a state directly chooses to insert themselves and your number one player or former number one player goes missing and you feel like they're not powerful, I think that's probably a good point that you just say no. And that's where I netted out this week, because I think that's probably fair.
Yeah, there has to be a line. This is a good one to learn to put a line in the sand. Bringing up the hydrogen bomb from there's a lot to unpack here. But I do agree that sport, you know, athletes have power, sports have power. We thinking about how the arc of this season, even with Naomi Osaka bringing attention to mental health, she did it last season with civil unrest in the U.S. as well. So to see it move from the hands of athletes to the hands of the organizations that are meant to protect them and stand up for them, I sound like a broken record, but like good on Steve Simon and the WTA, because he stands alone not only against like the behemoth that is China in the sporting world, but also stands alone among or other organizations and what they're willing to do for their players and for their teams. So it's once again very impressive.
Good on you, Steve Simon. Good on you, WTA. I think that's probably the place that we can leave part one, head into part two. Tennis did happen. We finally got to the end of the season. Unbelievably, after a long 2021, the Davis Cup concluded today as we record. The ATP also released their award nominees. We will try and do our best to pick some winners out of that. Join us in part two. Welcome back to the show. Priyanka, we did it. We made it to the end of the calendar. Can't believe it, given all the tournaments that's happened, given where we had. We started with all sorts of nonsense at the start of this year about figuring out whether we'd even get tennis going, a global tour, and we did. We conclude with a Davis Cup final. It's being played as we currently record. It's between Russia and Croatia. We saw an incredible streak extended by Novak Djokovic, and we also saw some incredible bant by Danny Medvedev, completely and utterly trolling the Spanish crowd. Your overall top levels from the Davis Cup over the past 2 weeks. Let me ask you a more pointed question on this. Do you care? I guess that's the real question I'm trying to get at here.
The short answer is no, she says. I feel like I spend so much time cultivating like an individual relationship with players that but I love team competition, right? Like I love the Olympics. I watch a lot of American team sports, but there's something about like the disconnect between rooting for individuals and following their storylines and like being a fan of certain athletes and then throwing them into a team. But even the country's team doesn't always feature the country's star player, and they're change in format is confusing. And so I like the extra tennis content. I like seeing Danny Medvedev throw some shade whenever he can. I'm a big fan of his on-court persona. So that was fun for me. I'm a fan. I'm happy for Rublev that he is ending his season on some wins, because he's kind of had a rough second half for being number five in the world. But other than that, you know, I saw that Tiafo had to cancel his vacation in Cabo to go play for this cup. And I was a little bit like, oh, that kind of sucks, dude. Like you were on the beach drinking mimosas and you had to get called back to it. But all that to say, I mean, if they're having fun, that's awesome. But for me as a tennis fan, it's lower on the events that I care too much about. What about you?
Can we just pick one team event and just go with it?
Yeah. Like,
it's so... It's exhausting trying to explain to people outside of this sport exactly what this event is compared to all the other ones that take place during the course of the year. I mean, we're up to three or four now of team competitions, which I'm not opposed to either. Like I share the same opinion with you. Like I think team competition in tennis, and I actually quite enjoyed the original version of the Davis Cup, like having home ties, being able to go to them, having the home team be able to pick the things. Like there's nothing really like that. It's fairly unique to the sport that you have the ability to pick a surface and to, you know, either do it at altitude or to take advantage of the place that you're actually in. I think that's kind of cool. But to have that sort of locked up and be sterilized in some way the way that it has been, I find it a little difficult to really support this endeavor across the board. But you never know. Like, I guess the quality of the tennis will ultimately win out on this. And that, maybe that's where this will net out in a few years' time, he says. Fingers crossed, maybe.
Potentially.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, let's get into what happened on the pathway to the finals. The Russian Tennis Federation, to give them their due and not actually give them their full name because they are discredited here, apparently, They should be in this final. They have the best team here by and large. They have the best players. They, by ranking, they should win this Davis Cup. And they've looked every bit the Davis Cup champions in the lead up to this. They absolutely, completely and utterly crushed the Germans in the semi-final. Rublev demolished Dominic Konfer. And Jan Lennard-Struff, as much as we love him, also completely and utterly capitulated when Medvedev just ground him down. It's kind of sad, I guess, in some ways, that you have a situation at the end of the year where you want to see the best competitive tennis. And really, this, especially in that first semifinal, was just a complete steamrolling.
Totally. And it again gets back to, like, if it's the best of the best, but it's a country competition versus individual competition. I mean, we just had the ATP finals, which are theoretically the best of the best as well. So we always love another opportunity for players. And I saw some great tweets of, like, Djokovic had all these goals this year around the Davis Cup and the Olympics and the Grand Slam, and he did none of it. And I'm like, he still won 3 Grand Slams, you guys. Like, all for using the Davis Cup to throw shade. But ultimately, it's there was some good tennis and there was some good aggro, as they say, in the industry as well. So That was the funner part for me.
I did enjoy watching Novak Djokovic kick the bag. It was quite amusing watching him acting small tantrum from a little kid. At least it shows it means something to him, right? And I know there's been question marks around his vaccination state and his everything that's going to happen in the next couple of months. And I think just to put that aside for a second and say that this man is ridiculously good in the Davis Cup. And I think anyone who says that he doesn't care about playing for Serbia is very, very inaccurate. He is well and truly now in the upper echelons of people in terms of Davis Cup streaks in history. He's 19 in a row. He's won 26 of his last 27 singles matches since the start of 2010. And he's 38-7 for his entire career. There's some pretty, pretty big names that he joins on the list. I bet you did not know who had the longest streak in Davis Cup wins. I had no idea, but did you know that it was Marcus Bagdatis?
I didn't. Not only have I not heard that name in a while, that was not the context with which I thought I would hear it, because especially if you look at the rest of the names on the list and what those guys have accomplished. Borg, Nadal, Becker, Djokovic, Murray, Rios, and Bagdatis. It's like a card game of how you would fill that last slot. Not the player I would have thought.
One of these is not like the other, as they say. Very much the case. And I guess, so Serbia lost 2-1 to Croatia. Djokovic won all his matches this week, and it really was going to always come down to whether or not Serbia could win the doubles. They didn't. Croatia went through. And I think, I say this now as we're recording, Andrei Rublev has given Russia a 1-0 lead. I think this is going to be a straightforward Russian win, but we say that, and we still have Dani Medvedev versus Marin Cilic to come, which could be pretty spicy.
You never know. You never know with Cilic. You never know with Medvedev, even though he's had an inconsistent end of the season. This season was long, and the beginning definitely had its ups and downs. So you never know with how spicy he's feeling as well. So we'll have to see.
I took word for word the way that Russell Fuller wrote on the BBC Sport page how Dani Medvedev acted with the Spanish fans. And I wanted to read it because it's so perfectly sterilized BBC in a way that I thought was hilarious. The Russians eliminated host Spain in the group stage, which Medvedev also enjoyed reminding the crowd about in his post-match interview. I'm really happy for the team to be in the final. It's been an amazing 2 weeks so far. Beating Spain was the highlight, he said. Beating the home favorites in Madrid made us all happy in the locker room. It was a nice feeling, and I'm happy about it. As jeers rang out behind him, he added, "People still don't understand how to make me lose. They should support me. It's okay, guys. I'm just going to continue to win." Yes, boy. Go for it. I love it. Like, you've got to have some pantomime villains in this thing.
I love it. I was like, 2019 US Open Medvedev is like the real Medvedev. Like, he was like nice for a little bit, and then now he's got the slam title under his belt, and he's like, I am who I am, and your jeers are only going to make me stronger, like a cartoon villain. I also got confused reading that, because if I read it as, "People still don't understand how to make me lose, they should support me." So is he saying that the more people support him, the more likely he is to lose? He's like, all of us who wanted him to get past like the first round of the French, should we have, you know, should we have not supported him and all that? So I enjoy the confusion there as well.
He's like the complete polar opposite to Francis Tiafoe. Like, Tiafoe wins when people support him. Medvedev loses when people support him. Yeah, maybe that's, exactly. That's quite amusing. Let's get to the ATP Players Awards. The nominees were announced this week. We did the WTA last week, and I think Karina and I got a little stumbled on and stumped on some of them because there were some really competitive categories. I think these are a little more straightforward. I feel like the ATP is a little more clear cut, but we're going to give it a go anyway, starting with the comeback player of the year. The ATP directly says the player who has overcome serious injury in reestablishing himself as one of the top players on the ATP tour. Now, top players is doing a lot of heavy lifting in that situation, in that sentence. The nominees are Thanasi Kokkinakis, Mackenzie McDonald, Andy Murray, and Jack Sock. I think Andy Murray wins this award, but I would also make a reasonable case that Mackenzie McDonald could win it as well. Where did you find yourself leaning on this one?
Those were also my top two. Murray just being the victim of the draws that he has had is absolutely, like, you couldn't write more difficult draws for, you know, for him to come back with his metal hip. And so I think that just the strength of the opposition and what he had to go up against to even get where he was, puts him slightly in my favor over Mackenzie McDonald, but McDonald was a close second considering the seriousness of his injury. And how, I mean, all the injuries were serious, but I think Murray, and one of my favorite gifts of all time, I'm going to use it to pump myself up, is when he says, I'm not done yet. Let's fucking go. Or excuse me, I'm not done yet. Let's go. It was really cool to see that passion from him after so long and after what he's accomplished. So I think that put him over the edge for me.
I think it's still incredible that he's doing this after he retired at the Australian Open a few years ago. I mean, it's incredible that a player is still going after being retired. You know, astonishing achievement for all involved. yes. Yeah, let's move on quickly from my trolling. I'm going to leave Most Improved Player for a second because I think that's a really spicy one. Let's go to the newcomer of the year. The next-gen ATP player who broke into the top 100 for the first time in 2021 and made the biggest impact on the ATP tour this season. The nominees are Sebastian Baez, Jenson Brooksby, Juan Manuel Sarandulo, Hugo Gaston, and Brandon Nakashima. I think Jenson Brooksby wins this award. This is a good list, though, and it is actually quite difficult to pick out of all of these who's going to have the best career, because I think Brooksby probably ends up having that, but it's a bit of a crapshoot after that.
Agreed. Brooksby was my number one. I was lucky enough to get to see him at the US Open this year against Karatsev.
Ooh, what a match.
That was really, really exciting. Lots of, it was late at night, so there was lots of drunk people in the crowd, I think is the technical term, that we're really excited to see Brooksby win. But even to see him up close, that he's definitely got the talent. But like Gaston had a great half of the season. Nakashima, we love an American player who makes, me, loves an American male player that can go forward. But I think Brooksby also wins it for me here.
Question for you, watching Brooksby up close and personal, especially with that crowd, do you get the sense that he does have, because I think you get it through the television, that he has a certain attitude about him on court and someone who is like ridiculously committed to the grind of the sport? Because I think that comes through on television. I'm curious to see how it does in person, though. Do you get that sense out of him?
He's definitely got a swagger to him. He's definitely got a belief. I mean, we walked in, I think at the fifth set, so it was pretty... I think that was a 5-set match. It was near the end of the match. They had to wait to let us in. So we just heard all the cheers and like the energy was really exciting. You can tell he fed off of that, and people who can wield that well. I mean, a bunch of people took sets off Djokovic this year, Holger Rune and Jack Draper and all these folks are like, yeah, we can take, we take stuff from the crowd as well. But it was definitely exciting to see how he sort of incorporated that on the field, on the court.
Let's talk about the Coach of the Year. Coach of the Year nominated and voted on by fellow ATP coaches. The award goes to the ATP coach who has helped guide his players to a higher level of performance during the year. We have Craig Boynton, who is Hubie Hurkacz's coach, Gilles Savana, who is Danny Medvedev's coach, Juan Carlos Ferrero, who most people will know at this point. Carlos Alcaraz is his coach, Facundo Lugones, who is Cameron Norrie's coach, and Christian Ruud, who is Casper Ruud's coach. There is some good names on this list and players who have had some banner years to get to these positions. Really, really tough picking this one, because you could go youth and say that the impact that Juan Carlos Ferrer has had on the young career of Carlos Alcaraz to make those strides. You could easily go with Christian Ruud, given what Casper Ruud has done this season to elevate himself. Mm-hmm. You could give it to Savara on the basis that Danny Medvedev won a Grand Slam. Or you could easily give it to Boynton on the fact that Hubie Hurkacz and, both of them, right? Hurkacz and Norrie both sit in that category of having banner career years. I don't know where I'd go on this one. I think that's an interesting one of how you evaluate a coach. Is it harder to take a player from 300 in the world inside of the top 50? Or is it harder to go from, you know, 6-2 or 15-10? Like, those are legitimate questions and ones that I'm curious. Who did you go with?
My gut went to the Hurkacz-Norrie camp of taking those players to the next level. Versus a Medvedev, for example, and taking those guys to, you know, top 10 rather in the world and taking them to truly the next level. I think Alcaraz, there's so much runway for him that the heights that he's going to reach under Ferrero, or if he eventually changes or adds coaches to his team, we'll see. It still like remains to be seen. So I think for me, the results that Norrie and Hurkacz had this year, those kind of floated to my top two. And I have a weird relationship with like parent coaches with like the Tsitsipases of the world. So not to say anything about, now that I even know anything about Christian Ruud in that regard, but those were my votes.
Yeah, I flat out just refuse to give a parent relationship here an award. It's just not happening, just given the problematic nature of what that looks like. And we all saw King Richard as well. So we know that there's both positive and negatives that come with this. I am going to give this to Facundo Lugones. I'm giving it to Cam Norrie's coach to take what Norrie has done and basically been a journeyman baseliner, to take that to playing in the World Tour Finals, I think is an astonishing, astonishing achievement. And one, who knows whether or not he can keep it up next season, but for one banner year the way that he had, I think that's an absolutely stunning achievement. I really do.
Totally agree.
Should we do the Sportsmanship Award? Like, we don't know how. Like, we have basically no insight into this, but let's pick our favorites anyway. The player who throughout the year conducted himself at the highest level of professionalism and integrity, who competed with his fellow players with the utmost spirit of fairness, and who promoted the game through his off-court activities. One player who did not make this list was Novak Djokovic. And I think that caught some ire of some people on Twitter this week in the tennis Twitter circle. The nominees are Felix Auger-Aliassime, Rafael Nadal, Casper Ruud, and Francis Tiafoe. I have no idea how to pick this. I just thought it was interesting to see all of the kerfuffle that ensued when Novak Djokovic wasn't picked for this list.
I think with the vaccination status piece, it's hard to have picked him, despite the wishy-washiness about vaccination status up until Tennis Australia really took a stand. I feel like that was a bit of a stain, perhaps, on Djokovic's candidacy for something like this. But he definitely stands up for the tour and for the players, and back to the Australian Open, you know, standing up for them in quarantine as well. So I was a bit surprised by that too, but I wonder if there's a bit of recency bias there, given all of the talk around if he's going to play and that piece of it as the coronavirus kind of rages on. So I don't know. I don't know how to pick. I'm not also like you, not privy to these guys in tournament and locker room behavior, but they all do seem like nice guys. I would get beers with all of them.
Yeah, they all seem like good dudes, don't they? Let's give an opener award to all of them. All four of these win, so congratulations. let's move on.
We've renamed it the Stefan Edberg Will We Get a Beer With Them Award, and so yes, they all win.
Which is a legitimate award, as we've established during this episode of the Will We Get a Beer With Them line that we have to overcome. The most improved player of the year. This is probably the most competitive one of the whole field. The player who has reached a significantly higher ATP ranking by year's end and who has demonstrated an increasing improved level of performance throughout the year. One player who does not make this list is Holger Rune, who took to Instagram this year and this week to voice his displeasure at not making this list. There is a thin line, Priyanka, I will say this, in defense of Holger Rune, between pumping your tires and being proud of the year that you've had and looking like a crybaby. And I don't know which side of the line you fall on. For me, it was a little bratty. But overall, I'm actually proud that the kid at least stood up for himself. But perhaps there's more useful situations to do that in.
Yeah, the Instagram comment is not necessarily, I think, the forum that's going to get you the results, Holger Rune. But I know he's been vocal about the rankings freeze and how that's affected him and his earnings. And there's probably some fair points in there. But I don't know that the Instagram comment is going to get you the result that you're looking for.
No, probably not.
Certainly. No.
All right. Pick a winner. Carlos Alcaraz, Aslan Karatsev, Cameron Norrie, Casper Ruud. This is an absolute bloodbath. Four players who have had incredible years, like just stunning achievements to go from where they were at the start of the year to make the rise that they have had. This one's a really tough one. I don't envision a scenario where I can pick against Aslan Karatsev, just given where he was at the end of last year and the run that he's had throughout the whole year and consistently to be a player that people fear now on tour. Carves Karatsev. He even has his nickname after him. But I think if you picked any other one, I would think that's fine as well. But I would go with Karatsev. And after that, I really wouldn't be able to pick one.
This is when I forgot how long this season was, because I was like, that was this Australian Open that he made that big run. Like, it has been a very long year, tennis and otherwise. Because when I first looked at this list, I was like, Karatsev? Oh, all right. And then I remember that it was in 2021. My pick might have been, due to recency bias, so the opposite effect, with Norrie winning Indian Wells and making it to the ATP Finals. And we just spoke about, you know, his coach and that achievement as well. Poor Casper Ruud and all of his other titles that don't seem to be resonating with us maybe as well. And once again, I fall on the same, like, Alcaraz probably has such so many more heights to reach, famous last words, but like he's going to go so far that Norrie was actually my pick at the end of the day. But
I think that's completely legitimate. I will just say, in defense of myself, Aslan Karatsev has been as high as world number 15 this year. 15?
Wow.
Man started outside of the top 100. It's astonishing. What a year. Incredible year. And is the recipient of so many fun memes throughout the year. He's entertained me in a way on tennis Twitter, and I do appreciate that. Let's probably leave it there. I'd be curious to know people's picks. Feel free to send them in. We can have some debate on that on Twitter as well. Let's get to parting shots, the last one of the year. There's some fun stuff in there. See you after the break. Welcome back to Open Era. It's parting shots, Bianca. It's, as Dev likes to say, it's everyone's favorite part of the show. It's the wild stuff. It's the Wild West, especially in the last week of the season. It's been some absolute crazy shit that's happened this week. Riley Opelka has been on fire all year on his Twitter account, which has been fun to keep track of. We Are Tennis put out a tweet during the course of, I think it was the back end of last week, actually, who were doing the listings. So player who made you fall in love with tennis, current favorite player, player who made you dream the most, et cetera, et cetera. Opelka put out Karlovic, Isner, Karlovic, and Federer, Nadal being the worst match he's ever seen. It was entertaining. It was very funny. Riley Opelka has kept us entertained. Let me just ask you this question. Player who made you fall in love with tennis? I know I'm not prepared. I didn't prepare you for this one, but I am curious to know. Do you have one on the top of your head?
It's a very, very run-of-the-mill answer. It's Rafael Nadal. I've been a Nadal stan, as the kids say, since 2005. Loved what he did for the sport. I remember I was his first French Open that he won, and he like thanked the ball boys. And I was like, he seems so nice on top of being a really good player. This is amazing. So he is definitely up there. And on the women's side, like being an American fan, the Williams sisters as well. So those would be my answers there. Very, very basic. Very basic answers. No deep cuts. No deep cuts over there.
No deep cuts. And I'll leave it in ambiguity to maybe I'll do this one with Dev. We can do this. We can revisit this one in our year-end episode, perhaps when he's recording again. I will ask you this: given that Rafael Nadal is currently on the shelf, who is your current favorite player?
Ooh, that's a tough. I'm kind of enjoying the wild, wild west of the ATP, at least on the ATP perspective. But I think I got to be honest, there's not a ton of personalities to root for. And that's a conversation for another time that I'm always interested in, like the post big three landscape and how people hang their hats on people. But I think right now it might be Medvedev. Another not deep cut answer. But I like that he plays like Squidward and like produces the results that he does. I think it's incredibly impressive. I think a spoiler at the US Open was one for the history books. And I always get happy when he wins. And I feel like that's when you know that you're like rooting for a team. Like when you find yourself watching a Premier League match that doesn't mean anything to you and you find yourself like fist pumping at a certain goal and you're like, oh, I guess I'm rooting for that person. Like that's how my relationship with Medvedev is involved. So he's one of my favorites right now. And then on the women's side, I have a ton as well. I think Sakkari is really high on my list as someone that I really like and want to do well.
I feel like this list on will be different depending on which tour you're looking at. I think the ATP is a lot more difficult to pick a favorite player, and I could pick probably 20 or 30 women who I really just genuinely enjoy watching and always pull for to see them try and get a result. I think it's a lot harder to find that on the ATP. And I think we've seen this year, unfortunately, a sort of blurring of the lines between that fandom of individuals crossed with some pretty questionable personality traits and comments in a way that tennis has rarely struggled. I think it's sometimes a struggle with it, but I think it's become very prominent this year in a way that it's pretty unsettling when you have sort of a final four or final eight in a tournament and you're looking at it being like, I don't really like any of these people. And I think that makes a pretty disastrous position for your tour to be in.
Yeah. And when you have folks breaking rules and making bathroom breaks, like the crux of their talent, and other folks with more serious stuff going on, like the rising stars of the tour having all this baggage in a way that the other, you know, the big three and even other players of the big three era and a big four era, I like to say it's a big four era, didn't have. It's definitely going to be tough to see once Djokovic kind of releases the grips, which might also not be for like 5 or 6 more years, the way that he's playing. So
I completely agree. If this doesn't end up with him winning another 5 or 6 Grand Slams, I don't know what version of he's pretty much down to whether or not he wants to, I think, at this point. But yeah. Somebody who won't win any more Grand Slams is Joanna Konta. She retired during the course of this week. She had, I'm going to say, a resounding silence from her fellow players and the tour. Not particularly liked from the women. We're playing armchair psychologist and we're playing armchair critic on this one. And I will say that maybe some kinder words were said behind the scenes that we weren't privy to, but I think it does speak to a position that many people don't really like Joanna Konta in some ways. I think vaccine comments had put her in some hot water in general. She can be a little prickly. That was announced a few times. I saw in some of the write-ups about Joanna Konta's career, it brought up a few times of her relationship with the press and some press members not being particularly big fans of her either. I think it was fairly harsh, some of the things that were said about why she chose to retire. The vaccine mandate, I think, is the obvious stick to beat her with on this one. But I do think she has suffered some pretty major injuries and some pretty major losses of form as well. I think it can't be easy to motivate yourself to come back in amongst the myriad of different reasons. But she was a good player. Do you have, let's say, positive memories of Joanna Konta's career?
I thought really hard about this when looking at the outline. And I gotta say, nothing really, really came to mind in particular. I think it's hard. It was probably hard for her too to see the spotlight of a Raducanu being such a beloved. I mean, with what she accomplished, of course, but even with her Wimbledon run, seeing the way that maybe you know better than me about the British public going behind her. Not that to say that Raducanu like contributed to Konta's retirement and pitting those women against each other by any means, but I think it speaks to like how hard it is to maybe make a splash on the tour when you don't necessarily have any of these special moments for us to look back on or for me to look back on. Do you have any special memories of her being sort of the highest ranked British women's player?
Not especially. I think making three of the four slams the semi-final stage is an achievement to show that this is a player who can play on all surfaces. This is clearly a talented player who you don't get inside of the top five without being an incredibly talented ball striker. I think she rubs a lot of people the wrong way. And I think that's been a problem for her entire career. And I don't know necessarily that that contributed to a warm reception. I think it probably, overall, I would say that her tennis deserved more love from the British public than I think she got, because to be the highest ranking woman in Britain for a long time and to make the semi-final stage in a period that was incredibly barren on women's tennis should be celebrated. And I think that is something that I thought was quite sad to see that that didn't get celebrated during the course of this week. Because whatever you think about her off the court and the way that she handles herself, from a tennis standpoint, she is she basically was the standard bearer for British tennis for a long time. And I think that probably deserved a bit more praise.
Yeah, it's disappointing, and maybe there's just also so much other news going on that it kind of fell under the radar from a PR press perspective that she didn't get enough love there, but maybe that's a charitable view.
Yeah, how about we just move on from Joanna Konza and leave it there? We can tiptoe around the subject. I saw someone refer to her as Tory Joe the other day, which I thought was quite funny. which I thought was quite entertaining. Someone that we have seen a huge amount of this year, Garbiñe Muguruza, had herself a week. She was touring all over Spain this week. She showed up at an award show, the Vanity Share Personality of the Year Award. She also met the King of Spain, and she was presented at the Bernabeu this last past weekend before Real's game against Athletic Club. What a year for her. What a back end of the year for her. I want to give that due before we get into her fashion update with Arthur Borges, but your top line levels from Garbiñe Muguruza.
Yeah, she absolutely had a great back half of the year. I was one of the few that was a little disappointed with her Krejcikova kerfuffle at the US Open. That didn't strike me as how I had seen her before, but I'm also... I usually give people the benefit of the doubt with things like that. Maybe I shouldn't. But other than that, you know, she's had an awesome year. I actually also just learned that there was rumors that her and Wawrinka used to date. Is that like a known thing that I completely missed?
I don't know whether this one's true, but this one has done the rounds, right? Like this one, there's no smoke without fire on this one, I think.
Yeah. And I also, you asked about her tennis, and that has absolutely nothing to do with her tennis, but I am excited to see what she can do. Her and the Osaka match from the Australian Open, that like could have been a final. She's had a great season, and I'm excited to see what she does next.
I mean, her tennis season is over, so we can talk about the other stuff off the court, right? Not least, we can talk about the fashion here, that she shows up to this event with Arthur Borges and who looks like a wax model. I'll be honest, like he looks like he could appear in Madame Tussauds in London. Like, take nothing away, he's an incredibly good looking dude, but he does look quite like he's made out of plasticine. Your thoughts, I guess, on Muguruza's outfit. She did show up at, tennis so rarely gets its moment in the spotlight, right? And especially when you have a woman who is so striking and imposing as Garbiñe Muguruza show up and presenting an award like this. I think it's quite fun occasionally to talk about this stuff. Thoughts on a dress?
I actually liked it. I like just going for it. Ruffles and kind of those louder details are having a moment right now. I found her dress in there's a picture of her, I think, in like Rublev walking around New York before the US Open. And she looks like his like chaperone on a field trip. Just like both of them dressed very, he's in like all black. It looks like he's, you know, listening to some thrash metal, like is upset that he has to not listen to his thrash metal and like walk around the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So all that to say, I was really impressed with her kind of glamming it up. I thought she looked great. And they're a very, very handsome couple. Like you said, they look like, he looks absolutely like he's a Ken doll.
So. Yeah, they're disgracefully good looking, the pair of them. It's not allowed. We need to ban them from ever going to events together. Makes us all feel bad. What a strange week. And I guess a strange year for Iga Świątek. This one is strange. So she splits up with Peter Sir Potowski during the course of this year. They'd been together for 5 years. very heartfelt post written by Iga on Instagram, thanking him for his work and all the things that came with it. I get messaged periodically by super fan of Iga Asia on Twitter. And believe me, she will let me know if I get this wrong. But I do find this one an interesting one because I saw periodically, now I need to check this one, but I saw Peter Sapkowski talking a few weeks ago about how they had plans in place for the upcoming season. It felt like this came all a bit sudden. So I'm not sure what is going on. It probably is a positive change to maybe split here and just given the year and trying to kick on. But does seem an interesting one, doesn't it?
Definitely. Swiatek had such a banner 2020 with that French Open win. But she also had a solid 2021. I think there's a sense that it was a disappointment for her. But at the same time, wasn't she the only player to make this, only women's player to make the second week of every slam, like in an incredibly inconsistent tour? Like she was pretty consistent. So it's not like she had this awful year and it's so clear that a change needed to be made. For example, maybe like a Pliskova and her coaching change last year. So who knows? Maybe there's better things on the horizon for her. Maybe I know she's been really open about the way her mental health plays into her play. So, you know, she's had some cases of nerves and maybe it's more of that angle as well. I mean, we only know so much, but I was definitely surprised to see this as well.
Quick shout out to Darlene Hart, who died in the course of this week. I was reading the obituary that the LA Times put out for her. By all accounts, an incredible player, a pioneer of the sport. Billie Jean King had some nice things to say on Twitter about her. She was inducted into the Tennis Hall of Fame in 1973. She won 3 Grand Slam titles in singles, just the 13 Grand Slam titles in doubles. So, you know, just nice casual. And casual and easy. Always sad to see pioneers, especially on the women's side of things. You look back in a lot of ways and look at some of these early women who are playing and the mark they left on the sport. It's pretty remarkable, really.
Yeah, I'm actually pretty ashamed to say that I hadn't really ever heard of her.
Mm-hmm. Which I think is telling, right? I think that's telling that like someone who is so prominent is in some ways not known widely.
Absolutely. I think there are so many tennis legends and I probably have to do a better job in my tennis history in general in some ways, but reading about all the success that she had, it was really impressive. And I was glad to see her not get her due necessarily, but to be talked about in such kind words for her accomplishments.
Bianca Andreescu is releasing a children's book the start of next year about sports, mental health, and furries, not furries in that capacity, furry friends. Before we get too far down a rabbit hole, I will leave that line there. The artwork on this thing looks very fun. Of course the dog appears in it. How could it not?
Right.
I thought this was actually quite cool overall. She seems like an interesting person, and I think this is an extension of trying to talk about things which are clearly important to her.
And it's cool to see that the book is about what I find is very impressive is like the mental side of the game. So her main character is sidelined by an injury, sounds familiar, and starts to doubt herself. And what it says, with encouragement from her mom and her dog, Coco, you know, she learns how to focus on what she's grateful for. Like, those are great lessons. And the mental side of tennis is something we talk about so often across so many players. And it's a cool thing to want to teach children from the beginning. And I am a dog owner and my dog inspires me too in different ways. And I would definitely feature her in a book if I had the opportunity. So I can get that for sure.
So let's close out parting shots with a quick chat on the tennis film landscape. Citizen Ash gets a limited release in the United States this week. I believe it's streaming on HBO Max starting today? Question mark? Maybe. Mm-hmm. Someone fact check on that one, but I think that's true. he is an amazing individual to learn about. Simply the activism that he has had or had throughout his entire life. I went back during the course of this week and was watching some previous Arthur Ashe matches as well. I have spoken on this podcast before about my love of his outfits and the choice and just the style that he brought to the whole scene. And in general, like, you watch him, he looks like a superstar, like a rock star on court. It's really awesome to see. But this is a documentary which looks at the activism and later life, along with some this course of his tennis career. I'm looking forward to checking this out. I don't know how I'm going to get it here in Canada, but we'll do our best. And I guess I encourage everyone to see that. As a side note, you wrote in the Patreon that you had some thoughts about King Richard. I wanted to give you the floor. I also saw it. The thing that I will say about it is I went to see it on Monday at midday, and there was no one in the cinema. I was there by myself. It was great. It was absolutely amazing to sit in a giant theater by myself. But let's have a quick 3-minute chat about King Richard, your top line thoughts about it.
So with background, I will say that two of my great loves are tennis and the movies. So I'm a big movie buff. I'm a big like Oscar buff, even though it doesn't mean anything. I'm very into like the narratives and this, that, and the other. So I first heard about King Richard actually through the lens of like Will Smith's Oscar career. And that was like, this was going to be his big Oscar return and things like that. And people being like, why did they make a movie when Serena and Venus are some of the greatest players of all time? Why did they make a movie about their dad? And I was kind of in that camp at the beginning, but they're producers on the film. Like, they clearly co-signed it. Their story is not over yet. I'm sure if they wanted to make a movie about themselves, they will eventually. but I went into it kind of excited to see his performance. People were saying really great things, and I really liked it. I thought Will Smith did a really good job. I think it's a solid sports movie that kind of glosses over like the details of tennis. Like, they never explain like how the scoring works. So I wonder if someone who's not as interested in tennis would be curious about the whole thing. And then, you know, a mild spoiler, I was really surprised to see that a bathroom break was like a key plot point in the movie. I was like, how very 2021 of them to have a bathroom break be a big deal. And I actually Googled if that was a real thing that happened, which it turned out that it was, as I speak in vague terms for folks who maybe haven't seen it. But all in all, I thought it was really good. I thought it was very moving. I got emotional at a couple points. And it was a good reminder of what a breakthrough Venus and Serena really were on the tour. I think they've become such legends that we kind of forget how big it was for them to break through. And it was a nice reminder of that moment in time of how exceptional that was.
We will do a wider review of King Richard in a couple of weeks' time, so stay tuned for that one. But top line levels, I will say, Soraya Sidney, who plays Venus Williams, she's left-handed and she plays this entire and gives this performance as Venus Williams playing right-handed in the most incredible way possible. She looks like a better tennis player than I am at the age of 11 or whatever she is at the moment. It's pretty, pretty remarkable. I think there is I think the film is pretty solid overall. And I think we can dig into more of that later on in another episode. But the top line level to me that I took away from it is this discussion about what was left out of the film and how the decisions got made to talk about Richard Williams. Because I think if you wanted to frame this and say that as a narrative, this is a fable of two young girls telling the story of their father, I think that's a much more accurate version of what this script and film became rather than the version of who Richard Williams actually is. And if you read more in depth about him, there's some obviously deeply problematic behavior which does not get remotely addressed in this film, not least accusations of domestic violence, some fairly horrible acts of and comments around anti-Semitism as well. These are not remotely in the film, and knowing why things got left out I think is quite an interesting discussion. But he's a divisive character, and I think this film, I think the fable route, I think, speaks more broadly to how I took away my view of what this film was like.
That's a great point. It's very family friendly. It's Will Smith, right? He's not going to do the most gritty, like most layered portrait. And there are some like kind of heavy handed moments in the script as well of like, we are different than the current tennis players. And it's tough for, like, they say a lot of things out loud that maybe a more nuanced portrait would have left to the imagination. So that's a really good disclaimer there. If you go too much into the real life of what Richard Williams was like, it's definitely not that.
Yeah, definitely not. Very far away from that, in fact. No. But last two challenges remaining the whole year. I'm going to let you have the last one. I'm just going to say that I've been watching iZombie on Netflix, which is a TV series. It's not great. It's definitely not. It's got its problems. But it's filmed here in Vancouver. So it's always fun for me to watch a show and to try and figure out the filming locations. I get to pause most scenes and be like, have I been to this place? I think I have. Zoom in, have a quick look. Yeah, I think I know where that is. And that's always fun, especially when you live in a city where a huge amount of filming happens. So it's pretty cool. Last one of the whole year. I give you the floor. Last one of 2021. Oh. Anything that you want to shout out that's non-tennis related?
So much pressure. I won't give Succession any more airtime than it already has. I think people already know that that's a good show, so that's not a great choice. I've been leaning into the holiday spirit of it all, and I just watched this very short, cute Norwegian Christmas show on Netflix called Home for Christmas. It's like 2 6 episode seasons about this woman needing to bring home a boyfriend for Christmas, and it takes place in Norway, and Christmas in Norway. I'm sure Casper Ruud has a very lovely Christmas, if this show is to be believed. And I liked that it was a little bit offbeat from your typical Christmas fare. So if you're feeling like getting into the holiday spirit, I would recommend it.
Thanks, Bianca. And thank you to everyone for listening to us throughout 2021. It's been a marathon. It's been a journey to get all the whole way. I think we've just about hit every week. I think we took 1 week off there in the summer. So we tried to get through every single week on the tour. You can follow us on Twitter at Open Era Pod. You can also find us on patreon.com/Open Era. The next few weeks, we have a couple of interviews lined up. I mentioned that we will be doing a review of King Richard as well. So stay tuned for that one. We have some topics from around the tennis circuit that hopefully you will enjoy. And then we'll talk to you at the start of January when Dev should be good to go. Fingers crossed. Hopefully he's recovering well. And have a fantastic holiday season. Stay tuned for our interview series, and we'll talk to you in 2022.